Welcome to another episode of Reboot with Dr. Arasi Maran. I'm your host, Dr. Arasi Maran. I'm an interventional cardiologist, but what I do as a faculty at the Medical University of South Carolina is completely separate from this podcast initiative. This initiative is hopefully to bring you evidence-based medicine right at your screens so that you can reboot your life at any time you want to, and you have enough information to empower yourself. So today we are going to deep dive into a very terrifying medical problem that has kind of started in India but has spread across the world. We are actually talking about antibiotic resistance and the evolution of superbugs. To kind of explain this and to teach me also, I have with me Dr. Ram Subramaniam, one of a world-renowned infectious disease specialist. He consults over several hospitals in Chennai, Tamil Nadu, India. He has been an author for more than 150 peer-reviewed journals. And his focus is antibiotic stewardship and antibiotic resistance. Without any further ado, Dr. Ram Subramaniam, thank you so much for joining me today.
Pleasure.
So can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey into infectious disease itself? Let's start there.
Yeah, I'm very happy to be with all of you today. And if you ask how my journey has been, ever since I was a young boy, my father is a doctor. He still practices, by the way. He's 94 and he still is a general practitioner in Chennai.
Fantastic.
So I was fascinated about the field of medicine. So when I learned about the terms bile and brain and all that when I was in my second or third standard, you know, it was very fascinating. So I decided I would be a doctor. So fortunately for me, I was doing well in studies. I finished my 12th standard and joined the Madras Medical College. After finishing the Madras MBBS and MMC, I was interested in taking up the post-graduation of medicine. And I got my seat in the prestigious Postgraduate Institute of Medical Education and Research in Chandigarh.
Oh.
And I did 3 years of there. It was a fascinating experience because, you know, you saw all kinds of cases. It was a tertiary institute. After I finished, again, I came to crossroads. What specialty would I take up? And I wanted to specialize, but at the same time, remain in medicine,
mm-hmm.
Which meant that cardiology, neurology, nephrology, all took you away from medicine.
Absolutely.
And at that time, HIV was really mushrooming in India. This was the late 80s and early 90s. And I thought HIV would be a good field to go in. And along with it came the parcel of infectious diseases.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I ended up in infectious diseases. I trained in the UK. And then I came back. It's over 25 years now, and I am still, you know, passionate about it, and I love going to work every day.
See, I think that's the only way you can still be in medicine, right? You have to be there. There is some sort of a nerdy passion which starts very early and moves on. But I had a similar interest like you. But the more I learned internal medicine, it definitely bogged me down. And I was like, I'm going into a subspecialty and switch to cardiology. And I love doing procedures, and that's how interventional cardiology came in. But I think that's the beauty of medicine. There is something for everyone and anyone who's interested.
True.
So with that, let's get into this. It is pretty scary, right? This whole evolution of antibiotic resistant superbugs, where a person just gets a random cut in their leg, but that gets super infected and, you know, and finally, ultimately, his life is in danger, amputation, things like that. Let's start at the basics. What is antibiotic resistance?
Okay, before I tell you about antibiotic resistance, let me tell you about how bacteria, or shall I say microorganisms, evolve.
Okay.
In nature, in evolution, the bacteria and especially the viruses, but even bacteria constantly keep changing.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a survival mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
So if, for example, you subject a virus or a bacteria to high temperatures for prolonged periods of time, you know, in a gradual fashion, they learn to survive even at high temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
So it is sort of an adaptation which they get from nature so that they change themselves, because the, basically the idea is survival of the fittest.
Absolutely.
So they have to learn new things. They have to undergo changes. They evolve. And a part of this process is what we call as mutation.
Mm-hmm.
Mutation basically refers to the changes in the genetic structure in bacteria or viruses, which give them usually a survival advantage. And this happens in nature. You know, constantly these changes happen. When you subject a bacteria to antibiotics, the antibiotics kill the bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
The bacteria over time find some ways in which they can survive in spite of the antibiotics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they undergo changes in the genetic structure, which, for example, may give them extra benefit so that the antibiotic is not able to enter the bacterial cell.
It could be
that it enters the cell, but it changes the receptor or the area into which on which the antibiotics sit.
Mm-hmm.
So by modifying that, they are able to survive because the antibiotics cannot attach and kill themselves. It could be by the production of certain enzymes, mm-hmm. which can kill the bacteria. It can be by blocking channels or coming up with pumps which will push the antibiotic outside the cell. So there are several mechanisms like this which the bacteria will slowly evolve with time if they are exposed to antibiotics.
Okay.
And these mutations are what give the bacteria an advantage of surviving in spite of exposure to the antibiotics, which normally should kill it.
Okay.
This is what we call as antibiotic resistance.
So, but this is a normal mechanism. So are you saying forever, in perpetuity, man and microorganism are constantly going to be fluxing each other?
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. In the sense that each person is naturally trained and given the mechanisms to keep changing,
mm-hmm.
so that they can survive.
Mm-hmm.
That is the normal process of evolution world over. So this has been happening for millions of years. If I tell you that antibiotic resistance is not something which has been seen recently,
mm-hmm.
it has been seen millions of years ago. For example, if you take the Alaskan permafrost,
yes,
and you drill holes into the ice a mile down, take a piece of ice and thaw it, people have shown that there are bacteria. And these bacteria have mechanisms of resistance within their genes.
Fantastic. My God. It's fantastic when it's look at it from a science point of view. It's very scary when you look at the human evolution point of view. So, but now what are the superbugs? What is this new bugs?
So, with the advent of antibiotics have been around for just over 100 years now.
Mm-hmm.
In the long span of millions of years, it's only just over 100 years. So, when they started inventing antibiotics or even discovering antibiotics, because antibiotics, a lot of them are produced by fungi.
Yeah.
So when these antibiotics were used to kill bacteria which were causing infections in man, the bacteria slowly again evolved to develop resistance. So
mm-hmm.
it has been shown, if you look at the scene of antibiotic developments, every time an antibiotic was introduced, within a matter of 2 years or 3 years, the bacteria will evolve, which become resistant to the bugs. So I reiterate that antibiotic resistance is something which is seen in bacteria. It is not a human thing. It is not in the surroundings. It is the bacteria which develop the ability to fight or survive in spite of antibiotics.
Hmm.
That is resistance. So they develop this within a couple of years of exposure to the new antibiotic.
Okay.
So every time you come up with a new antibiotic, it is just a matter of time before the bacteria develop resistance.
So compared to 50 years ago to now, is the time to resistance decreasing?
Exactly. We find that sometimes even before the antibiotic is licensed and disused, already the bacteria have developed
the resistance. Bacteria, like how humans have developed artificial intelligence, the bacteria seem to be getting way more intelligent.
Yes, and if a bacteria develops resistance to several classes of antibiotics, that is what we call as a superbug. In other words, there are antibiotics which act by different ways.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
if you have five different classes acting in different ways and the antibiotic, in spite of the bacteria being exposed to that, the bacteria survive, it means it is a multi-drug resistant bacteria or a superbug.
So let me ask, you know, for the sake of this podcast, we are saying bacteria. Is this mainly happening only in bacteria, or is it also happening for viruses and fungi? Like, what do you...
It happens everywhere.
No, but the speed at which the resistance is happening. Do we have multi-drug resistant viruses?
Yes, we do have. It is just because bacteria cause the most infections in humans, the chances of antibiotics being developed and the chances that the bacteria is being exposed to antibiotics is much higher than other organisms like viruses or fungi. So you have multi-drug resistant fungi, you have multi-drug resistant viruses. So the antivirals which act against the viruses, the viruses may be able to survive in spite of that.
You're dampening my spirits a little bit now. There was a reason why I didn't go to infectious disease in life. So when you say a super bug, so it's resistant to multiple different types of antibiotics.
Yes.
What is the solution? How do you treat them?
See, the solution... If I want to disappoint you, there is no solution to this.
Okay.
It's like you can equate it to the Cold War. You know, when there was a Cold War going on, even though subtly it goes on now, when there are two superpowers, there is no end. Because when you do something, the other power does something more. You have to keep doing something more. So similarly, the population. So when there is a rise in population, the resources become scarce.
Okay.
And you have to develop more resources for the population.
Okay.
So it's an escalating conflict for which there is no solution. In fact, somebody had referred to this as the tragedy of the commons. What do you mean by tragedy of the commons? During the Victorian times in England, the royalty gave away, you know, meadows or lands for grazing of the sheep for the farmers. The problem was none of the farmers took onus for the land. They let their cattle graze in that area. So much so that after about 5-10 years, the entire land was barren because the cattle had eaten everything.
Yes.
And the people who were using it had no interest in developing it.
Yeah.
So that was called the tragedy of the commons. A common land, a common resource is being used by several stakeholders who don't have any personal ownership in that. And that eventually leads to, you know.
Now, that kind of leads to my next question. Who has ownership of this? Patient? Or the physician, or the hospital, or a governmental institution?
Everybody. This, the antibiotics, the antivirals, the antifungals are not the sole property of anyone. So which means the companies which come up with developing these you know, products, they spend millions of dollars, millions of rupees to come up with it. Then the doctors who use it, the patients who use it on themselves, the government which comes up with laws, for example, in India, only recently they brought a rule in saying that antibiotics can be cannot purchased over the counter.
Okay.
So you come up with a system where there is a regulation of antibiotic use. The doctor should come up with guidelines on how to use antibiotics. The hospital should restrict use of certain antibiotics which have to
Absolutely.
Be reserved as, you know, important antibiotics.
Yes.
You should stop using, you know, growth promoters, which are basically antibiotics, which are used for poultry and the cattle industry for growth of healthy cattle and poultry. If you use it already, by the time a healthy chicken or a healthy, you know, cattle is grown and consumed or slaughtered, it already has bacteria in it, which
is antibiotic resistant.
And if they enter the human system, they can cause problems.
So it's basically starting that low level in the food chain, where the food we eat has bacteria, which has got antibiotic resistance, and we are consuming, and our gut microbiome is already exposed to that.
In fact, antibiotics are the only class of drugs which just not only affect the person on whom you use it, but the entire community. I can use an antihypertensive, I can use an antidiabetic, I can use an antipsychotic, and it affects only the person on whom it is used. But when I use an antibiotic, it basically affects what we refer to as the microbiome, the normal bacterial flora sitting in my gut. The gut is full of bugs.
Yes.
So this antibiotic affects not only the bad bugs which are causing infection, it affects the good bugs. So when I am, you know, passing out fecal matter, this fecal matter will contain bacteria which are resistant. This contaminates water systems. This contaminates the environment, which is exposed to, you know, say cattle or pigs or whatever. So it spreads through the entire community. So when I use antibiotic on one person, it can impact the whole community.
Well, I don't think this kind of importance of that has ever been, this information has never been disseminated aggressively. either by governmental institutions or even by us doctors. We don't, you know, we don't go out preaching. I mean, I preach about diabetes and obesity and heart disease, but I'm not preaching about antibiotic resistance. How do we change that narrative here?
What you're saying is very true. People don't realize the magnitude of the problem. This mm-hmm. is an emergency.
Yes.
We are now sitting on a situation where we are slowly sliding back into the pre-antibiotic era.
Oh, wow.
Because even though we have so many antibiotics, mm-hmm. it appears that a lot of them are becoming useless. Mm. So, which means, like the 18th century or the 17th century where they did not have antibiotics, we are approaching that. It may sound a little dramatic, but that's
where we are getting. And how did India become the epicenter of this?
Now, in India, traditionally, there have been a lot of challenges. One, antibiotics are freely available. Mm-hmm. Two, because the way they are licensed antibiotics, anybody can come up with something new. You can put two antibiotics together and bring it out as a product. And the drug controller has been licensing it over the last several decades.
Okay.
Three, it has always been easier to treat a person with antibiotics, less expensive than to investigate the patient. I'll give you a simple example. If I need to confirm a bacteria, let's say typhoid, and the correct way of diagnosing typhoid is not by the viral test, it is by doing a blood culture. That is the correct way to do it. Mm-hmm. Doing a blood culture may cost 2,000 rupees.
Okay.
It will take about 3 to 4 days for you to get the results. And the culture is only about 60 to 70% sensitive in picking up the bacteria.
Okay.
Whereas the treatment I could use for it, whatever antibiotic, will cost me about 200 or 300 rupees at best.
So it was cost efficient.
Why should a person go to a doctor, pay his consultation fees, when he can think, oh, it could be typhoid, I'll ask the pharmacist and pop in the pill.
So, typical example of penny-wise, pound-foolish.
Yes, absolutely. Correct. So, there are a lot of reasons. So, it could be the cost. Mm-hmm. It could be access to getting medicine. So, whatever medicines they have, they take it. A lot of patients tell me, you know, last time I had fever and you gave me this antibiotic. This time, I took the same antibiotic.
Okay.
You know, without realizing that the antibiotic is selected based on what drug, what bug and where the infection is. Mm-hmm. So, for all these reasons and more, antibiotics have been rampantly misused, abused, exploited in India.
So, when you use
more antibiotics, mm-hmm. if you look at the tonnage of antibiotics used in and compare it to various countries, India has one of the highest tonnage of use.
But India is also a country where access to care is difficult. Okay, so when they don't have doctors and access to care, maybe just, you know, there are probably more pharmacists than doctors, and that is also probably contributing.
That's a valid point. Because of these reasons, the government doesn't want to restrict availability or access to antibiotics. Because in the West, they have said that only, for example, infectious diseases doctors can prescribe this antibiotic. It's a high-end antibiotics only ID doctor can prescribe. Whereas in India, we have probably about 100, 150 of ID specialists for a population of 1.5 billion.
Yes.
So they let everybody write. They make it easy for people to get antibiotics. So the idea is a person shouldn't die because of some rule which restricts antibiotics.
Absolutely. Are there set of tests a doctor has to do to make sure this antibiotic is prescribed for the right reason?
Yes. If you look at it theoretically, you can come up with a template to say that this is the exact way to investigate. If a person is having fever, don't give an antibiotic unless you confirm a diagnosis, which is an ideal way to do it. But unfortunately, we don't live in an ideal world. Mm. There could be problems with the paying capacity. As I told you, if I ask the patient to do a blood culture, he says, doctor, if I don't go to work tomorrow, I will not have money to feed my family. So give me something quick which makes me better.
Yeah.
So what happens? You start popping in antibiotics. It could be access to tests. Mm. This is a test to be done, but the test is not available.
Yeah.
Maybe it is not available in the government center. You have to do on the private side, which costs money. Once you do the test, the turnaround time is there.
Much
so
longer,
it may take 4 or 5 days. The patient cannot afford to be sitting at home or sitting in a hospital waiting for the results to come. You come up with guidelines to do it. The guidelines have to be evolved in India.
Yeah.
I cannot put a guideline available from the US and say it will work in India.
Yes.
So there are a lot of practical issues which make it very difficult for a set like this to do.
So, but are there any antibiotic stewardship programs which are kind of conducted in India to somehow at least contain this problem?
Right. So let me tell you a bit about antimicrobial stewardship or antibiotic stewardship. What do you mean by antibiotic stewardship? It basically refers to putting in place a system whereby the person uses the, or the doctor prescribes the correct antibiotic or the appropriate antibiotic. So the judicious use of antibiotic is ensured by this system. So what does it involve? It involves four or five things. The West has come out with a very elaborate system in place, but we have to customize it to our needs.
Yes.
So an antibiotic stewardship basically means, one, you collect data, microbiology data from several hospitals. It could be community infections. Mm-hmm. It could be hospital infections.
Okay.
What do I mean by hospital infections for, again, the viewers? A lot of infections you get from the community. For example, a flu, a typhoid. It could be tuberculosis. Mm-hmm. These are generally from the community.
Mm-hmm.
But when a person is admitted to the hospital, he has a bypass surgery. When you have a bypass surgery, post-bypass, you get an infection in the wound.
Mm-hmm.
This is a hospital-acquired infection.
Yes.
I didn't come to the hospital with an infection.
Yes.
I had a surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Post-surgery, I developed.
Yeah.
I have a stomach surgery. I have a gallbladder removed. Post-gallbladder removed, I develop a pneumonia.
Yeah.
I end up on the ventilator.
Yes.
So these are hospital acquired. So the usual causes of community acquired infection and hospital acquired infection is different. Caused by different bugs, different patterns of resistance, and in general, hospital acquired infections are caused by drug resistant superbugs.
Okay.
So what was I saying? So,
stewardship.
Yeah. So stewardship starts with collecting data to find out, in Chennai, for example, in my hospital, the common causes of infection, community acquired infections, are typhoid, malaria, dengue, scrub typhus, and the causative agent will respond to this antibiotic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In hospital acquired infections, in general, the pneumonia which I get in hospital is caused by maybe E. coli, Acinetobacter, Klebsiella, and the susceptibility pattern of the various bacteria is this.
Mm.
And this varies. What is happening in Chennai may be different from what happens in Calcutta or Delhi. So I collect data, regional, geographically localized data, to decide what are the common bugs causing the common infections, what is the susceptibility pattern. Based on this, I come up with an antibiotic guideline.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So if in Chennai I suspect typhoid, I will use either azithromycin or cotrimoxazole.
Okay.
Because ciprofloxacin, which is the
all-time
the antibiotic which is recommended by many, many countries,
will not work
in Chennai. So I have to customize the antibiotic plan or the guideline based on what the prevalent infection is.
So basically, antibiotic stewardship is kind of creating a personalized plan for every geographical subdivision.
Yes.
Okay.
So you collect the data, you prepare the antibiotic guideline, you ensure that you have a system in place so that the guideline is used correctly. There's no point in having a guideline and nobody follows.
Uses it, yes.
Use it. You track the use of antibiotics in your hospital.
Mm.
In the outpatient department, how the antibiotic used. So you have a mechanism of auditing and tracking it. Apart from that, you also educate.
Okay.
You have to document it and you educate it. You audit it, document it, audit it, educate, improve awareness. All these factors are part of any antibiotic.
But who is the data collector? Who's managing? Who owns and does the data?
The hospital administration is what is responsible.
Okay.
And it should have a system in place. So usually it is led by either an infectious disease physician or a general physician with special interest in antibiotics. You need to have an infection control nurse or an antibiotic nurse. You need to have somebody from the IT department who will collect the data. You need to ensure that the microbiology department collects the surveillance data, and you have a hospital antibiotic policy made. So it involves a lot of departments, but the onus will be on the hospital administration to put it in.
Am I correct in assuming all hospitals, irrespective of their size, have to have this in place?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And that's mandated by the government?
Yes. For example, if it depends on the accreditation body. So if it's an international body where the Joint Commission International, JCI does it, JCI insists on this. In India, you have the NABH, the National Board, where they have an NABL and an NABH. This is one is for lab and one is for hospital.
Okay.
They have antibiotic stewardship as a very, very important part of their auditing process.
Okay, fantastic. At least, I mean, we are taking steps.
Absolutely.
It feels collecting ammunition to fight the war against the microbes. And
this may be a little too late, but still, better late than never.
But how does, you know, sometimes I see random articles here and there, AI is going to be the game changer, and AI is going to help us come up with, is going to help us outsmart the bacteria. What do you think about that?
I don't think we'll ever outsmart the bacteria.
Nature wins.
See, if you look at the evolution of life on this planet, mm-hmm. and put the entire, say, it is about 6 billion years before the universe was formed, and then, you know, life came about several million years ago.
Yes.
You put that in a 24-hour clock, mm-hmm. you'll find that if bacteria evolved at minute 15, mm-hmm. and, viruses evolved around minute 20 or something, and you trace it down, dinosaurs evolved around the post-50th minute.
Okay.
And man came into existing
so way
56th
back.
Or 57th minute, which means there
they
are
have outlived
millions
us.
Of years of experience and evolution they have gone through, and they are much smarter
much,
than
humans. Okay, all right.
So fine. AI, no AI, I don't think that's going to find. We may be able to make a way to handle them better, mm-hmm. may get some insights based on the history and feeding them in,
yes.
coming out with better approaches,
okay.
but winning the battle.
Okay. Spoken like a person who loves infectious disease so much and is passionate about microbes. He has studied a lot.
In fact, the number of bacteria which are sitting on our skin and inside our body,
yes.
if you put all of them together and they all decide to kill the person, you need a fraction of,
Absolutely.
It is called endotoxins.
Yes.
They can produce 100 times more amount of endotoxin to kill you immediately.
You know, we are all so similar in, the way you're thinking about endotoxins, and I think about calcium, coronary calcium in the heart and things like that. And I always, interventional cardiology, people think it's a very, they are very proud and, we fight heart disease. And I'm like, how are you guys even having that ego? A 0.25 millimeter coronary calcium can cause a perforation or a clot, which is so, less than a millimeter in diameter. Can kill a human being. I mean, we are fighting something that small. So where does ego come? And I can see the same sort of insight with you that
you're not even able to see the bugs.
Yes.
Bacteria or viruses you can't see with your naked eye.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and there is our gut microbiome decides our mood, decides our personality, decides our hunger scales, etc. Right? So we are in fact controlled by which bug is dominant in our gut and so on and so forth. So moving on from here to, diabetes and obesity, diabetic patients are in general more susceptible to infections, high blood sugars, bacteria love sugar and they feed. Is India's diabetic or even the world's diabetic obesity epidemic adding to this problem or part of the problem itself?
Yes, they're all interconnected, mm-hmm. because there is enough evidence to say that people who are diabetic have a higher risk of developing infections and probably have higher risk of complications.
Yes,
also.
Yes.
Whether it's a pneumonia, whether it's a urinary tract infection, in general, people who are diabetics are at a higher risk of having these infections and complications.
Okay.
There are several reasons. It could be the increased sugar, how it affects the immune pathways,
system, yes.
how it affects the cytokines. Several ways it has been proved. So yes, which means diabetics, especially poorly controlled diabetics.
Mm-hmm.
If your sugars are very well controlled, I don't think you need to worry.
But in a
place where people have difficulty controlling the taste buds and their craving for mm-hmm. sugar, mm-hmm. it's very difficult. So naturally, both infections, antibiotic resistance, and complications are all higher with diabetics.
So now with the GLP-1s and, they are taking the whole world, including India, by storm. And maybe this is a cure for, maybe we will control obesity like we control high blood pressure or high cholesterol. Do you think this will alter this antibiotic resistance mechanisms?
Not directly, but mm-hmm. as I said, they are all interconnected.
Okay.
Obesity is not one, it is not directly linked to infections or drug
okay.
resistance, but obesity affects the functioning of several organs in the body.
Yes.
So when you work as a system and there is something wrong with one system, it impacts all other systems. So it's like that. It will definitely impact on infections, but not
diet. Not necessarily. Now, the other big question, it's more of a curiosity point. You know, everybody right now, gut health, gut microbiome, it is like the hot topic, right? After Ozempic, maybe this is the most searched term. Then I see a lot of these wellness centers or longevity centers, which basically have patients or people, human, they're not patients at that time, they're just regular people, send stool samples and look at the microbacteria, microbiome mapping of their stool. And they come up with, you have overinfection of Candida or you have overinfection of this, and without any symptoms, prescribe antifungal agents and things like that. What are your thoughts about it? Is there any science to this?
Not yet. In other words, these are areas where we are just coming to know about things. It's like the AI, for example. You know, there are so many predictions about AI. It's going to do this. You're going to be out of jobs. You're going make us treat patients better. We are still not clear about it, but we know the potential probably. Like that, we have realized that, as I said, the amount of bacteria in our system is so high that it has to have some impact on the way we lead our lives. Whether it is related to the activities, how it affects our brain, whether it is cause for depression, whether it causes good chemicals to build up, we still don't know yet. And whenever there are a lot of theories about something, that means we don't know.
Okay.
And there are a hell of a lot of theories about microbiomes and how they may impact health. Because we don't know things yet, there are various things people like to do. For example, autism. Is it correlated with the microbiome? You know, the way, the kind of the mental problems which we see, are they related? They could be, but we don't know yet. And right now, reacting, you know, in a knee-jerk fashion to treating, as you said, Candida. Candida is a normal fungus which is colonizing our gut. It is there, right from your mouth, it goes straight down. So as long as it is inside the gut, it's not a problem. It gets into the blood, that is a serious problem. So we don't know yet, but at this point, you know, coming up with theories and, you know, acting based on theories, we need to get more information. We need to do more studies. We need to show correlations. But I think we are way behind.
And that's what bothers me. We are commercializing this and it's become like, oh, I do a gut check or something like that. I'm like, these are supposed to be inside your body. And, you know, what are we doing about it? So kind of let's kind of move into maybe a rapid fire or a short answer, not a whole thing. Are diabetics or are people with insulin resistance and slightly elevated blood sugar more likely to be bit by mosquitoes than a non-diabetic, non-insulin resistant person? Is there?
So it's like once the mosquito feeds on somebody and wants some dessert, then they zoom in on a diabetic and suck the blood. And no, I don't think diabetics are, there is a direct connection between mosquito biting and people who are diabetics.
Because I was like, I've never heard of this, but that's interesting. Now, whenever you have a cold, right, there is all, and this is, I think, more, I know the type of people who are saying this myth, but let's hear it from you. Oh, drink some whiskey and you can kill the cold bug. Is there any truth to that?
Oh, people who love whiskey must be saying this. So no, I don't think drinking whiskey will help. Though people, again, about 100 years ago, when there was no actually treatment available, used to mix alcohol with a lot of stuff to make them feel better. And brandy was recommended as a treatment for cold. It is more, it used to
symptomatic
sort of
comfort, maybe
invigorate you a little bit rather than actually do anything.
So then how about this immunity booster shots, vitamin C, turmeric, zinc, etc.? Does that realistically shorten the duration of a cold or prevent you from having a cold?
There have been a lot of theories. There have been some evidence also. But there have been immediately another study has come up saying that, no, this doesn't work. For example, industrial doses of vitamin C, not the 500 and 1,000. We are talking about several grams or tens of grams of vitamin C actually help the cold. But when you take it that way, you're going to end up with renal stones. You're going to have, you know, several other complications. So, no, in the sense that they don't have definitive information to say that they make a difference. These are all, you know, fancy thinking with, you know, faith-based interventions. For example, we also use a lot of kashayams and other stuff which party used to make, which really used to work.
Okay.
So is it just the placebo effect that you take it, you feel good, and then you get recover fast? Or does it actually make a difference?
We don't know. I think that is the bottom line answer.
Because as I said, this placebo effect is something phenomenal where if I tell you, you take this tablet and you will lose weight and you can lose weight.
Yes.
It's like that. It's your mind deciding how things work.
Absolutely. Now, you know, there was this whole, you know, superbug evolution, etc. We have MRSA or methicillin resistant staph aureus infections, very predominant. Patients get swabbed in the hospitals, and now they all make us wear these plastic gowns and gloves and things. And we change from room to room. I find the whole practice not like what we did for COVID, not the whole head to toe. We walk into the room, we wear it outside the room, walk into the room, examine the patient, take it off, open the dustbin inside the patient room, dump it. But then the patient will ask us a question, start talking a few more minutes, then come outside. Are we actually controlling the spread of MRSA by this practice?
Okay, again, for the benefit of the viewers, there are certain bacteria. The bacteria are transmitted from one person to another by various mechanisms.
Yes.
For example, if I have flu and I sit here and cough, if I have COVID, if I cough, it travels through the air and you inhale, you can get it.
Yes.
Chickenpox is like that.
Yes.
There are certain infections which transmit only if
I touch
contact
with
it.
Yes.
This could be sexual infections. This could be methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. This could be scabies, where you touch somebody who has the infection and you pick it up.
Yes.
There are certain other infections which travel, fecal-oral, typhoid, cholera. So if I handle a patient with cholera and my hands get contaminated with that cholera and without washing it, by mistake I take it near my mouth or eat some food, I can get cholera.
Yes.
So based on the mode of transmission, we try to put in place certain precautions, what we call as isolation precautions for patients in hospital to prevent that infection transmitting from one person, a patient, to another patient.
Okay.
And as you said recently, there are several groups which MRSA is one of them, highly resistant superbugs if they colonize or infect a patient. And as a doctor, I examine the patient and I tend to carry, because when you have the infection, you shed the the bacteria around
through
yourself.
Your skin.
So if I handle the patient and without washing, I go and touch another patient, I may transmit the infection.
Mm-hmm.
So to prevent that, we follow what is called as contact isolation.
Mm-hmm.
That is, if I'm going to come into contact, I should wear some form of gown so that when I lean to examine the patient, I don't pick it up on my dress and then go and drop it off
into another patient.
I need to wash my hands, all those things. So, depending on the extent of contact, this is very clearly proven that medically, by doing these, taking these precautions, you prevent transmission.
Okay.
Otherwise, you may create an outbreak or in the hospital.
Yes.
So you have to use it with a lot of common sense. So, what bacteria, what kind of contact, what kind of, you know, chances of it jumping all those, and then you come up with guidelines to see whether it helps.
Okay.
So, yes, some sort of guidelines that is very important. But you need to temper it to suit your local issues.
Now, coming with this whole contact, etc., Western toilets, okay, does it make a difference? Are you likely to get infections from a, you know, uncleaned? I mean, obviously, if it's obviously visually dirty, it's a different thing. But visually, it doesn't look dirty. And people have thoughts about, oh, I'm going to get a urinary tract infection because I sat on a dirty toilet. Does it have any backing?
No. Urinary tract infections are not transmitted from public toilets or common toilets. Whatever, urinary tract infections are caused by bacteria which specifically enter into your urethral tract from outside.
Mm-hmm.
And this is usually your own bacteria from your own gut.
Yes.
So the distance between, especially in women, the back passage and the urinary passage is very,
very close by.
So the chances of bacteria coming in through that and causing infection, especially in women who hold their urine for a long time, who don't use, you know, public bathrooms, is very high. But you don't pick up infections. But if those people who are very worried, very, you know,
germophobic,
what I would say is just take a tissue paper. So before you sit on a public toilet, just wipe the seat and then sit. That's all you need to do.
So holding your urine is more dangerous and can cause urinary tract infections than using a public bathroom. So yes, please keep that in mind, especially women. So now hand sanitizer. You know, again, with the COVID era, we all started like hand sanitizer to the point where, you know, skin became dry and nails became, etc. Should we lean more on hand washing or hand sanitizer?
Till hand sanitizers came into vogue a couple of decades ago, only thing we had was soap and water.
Yeah.
Okay. I remember my grandmother telling me that if you go out of the house, play and come inside, make sure you wash your hands and legs.
Yes.
And then come in. Mm-hmm. If you're going to eat, wash your hands and then sit down. If you visit the toilet, as soon as you come out, wash your hands. These are simple things which can be done
basic
in most places.
Basic hygiene, yes.
Okay. But medically, they've shown that by using alcohol gel on hands which are not wet, is actually better than washing hands.
Okay.
So if your hands are wet, if I touch something, it is water or whatever fluid and my hands are wet.
Yeah.
No to alcohol gel. You have to wash your hands. But dry hands, you know, especially in hospital where we are dealing with patients, we use that often. But it comes with its baggage of making it dry and cracked and all those things.
Okay.
So the options are hand washing with soap, not the bar soap, which many people can use. A liquid soap, which is this thing is perfectly fine. If your hands are not soiled, if you don't have access to water, if you're outside, using alcohol gel is fine.
Okay.
You don't need to become totally addicted to it, but in certain situations, yes, it is definitely indicated.
And there's also this whole theory, widespread notion that we have created superbugs because we are using too much of alcohol gel, hand sanitizers.
No. Though there are questions that alcohol, by using it frequently, again, by exposing bacteria to do this, will the bacteria develop resistance to this?
Mm-hmm.
Not in any serious fashion
At this time. Okay.
So you don't need to worry too much.
Fantastic. All right. So we're kind of coming close to our session here. If there is one piece of advice you want to give to the regular person who's to kind of limit the antibiotic resistance, etc., what would that be? You can give more than one piece of advice.
We are in an era where people want instant gratification.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you go to the doctor saying, I've had fever since morning, I have to go to work tomorrow, give me something. Now, if you have the flu, you will go through 3-4 days of miserable existence before you get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
We may give medicines to make it milder, but we cannot clear it. Mm-hmm. I have people who come to me saying, I've had 5 times loose stools, I wanted to stop. You give the medicine, they call in 2 hours are saying, I'm still having loose stools. No, short of putting a plug up there to block it, you are not going to have an instant solution to it. So you have to be patient. Nature has its ways of doing things. We can make it easier to accept certain problems, but there are no shortcuts to this.
Yes.
So learn to be patient. Learn to be acceptable to what is happening in life. So don't expect that medicines can work miracles. Though it has been proclaimed that science has advanced so much that we are able to live longer, we still have to die one day. It's been said that the only guarantee in life is that we'll all die one day.
Yes, yes.
We may push it by 5 years, 10 years. That's all we are doing. So don't expect miracles. Now, with regard to specifically infectious diseases, one simple advice I'd like to share with you is the stronger your immune system, the better you'll be able to fend off diseases. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So how do you keep your immune system stronger? One, eat good food, a balanced meal, whether it is vegetarian, whether it is non-vegetarian, whether it is intermittent fasting, take a balanced meal. Okay? Two, rest. You have to have your 7 hours sleep. It's been shown that people who sleep 5 hours or less, or people who sleep 10 hours or more, are at a higher risk of dying than people who have the 7 to 8 hours sleep. So make sure that you are rested. Three, this thing, of course, food comes with hygiene. Take your vaccine shots regularly. Vaccines are not only for young kids. As you grow older, beyond the age of especially 55 or 60, you do expect your immune system to start waning. So take your vaccines regularly. Four, smoking and drinking. Very clearly shown that even alcohol, which was once thought, if you take in moderation, is actually healthy.
Now
they have said that even taking a little alcohol is worse than not taking alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
So be sensible.
Yeah.
Five, exercising.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure that physical activity, now with the kind of phones and all that. Nobody, all day when you say you play games for an hour, it's playing games on your
absolutely.
System. No, you have to get out. Anything, walking, running, jumping, swimming, whatever, cycling, do some at least half an hour a day, 5 days a week. Very clearly shown. And lastly, stress. It's been clearly shown that stress impacts your immune system. So whether it is meditation, whether it is pranayama, figure out a way to calm yourself so that the less stressed you are, the more robust your immune system will be. So these are the simple things I would advise for people to take.
Fantastic. I think you kind of summarized all the episodes we've been doing for the past 1.5 years. But because these are the basic common themes and for whichever, whether it's the cardiac system or the GI or the neuro system or thing, these are the seems to be the common basic principles. Thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate you taking time. And once again, if you know someone who you think will benefit from listening to this episode, who is either germophobic or who is loves to take an antibiotic every time they cough or sneeze, please share it with them so that they don't contribute to this antibiotic resistance emerging. Thank you, and I'll see you with the next episode.